tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Why should you want to know?
Because, like it or not, Seattle is now home base to the world's most controversial oil exploration effort. Welcome to Friday. This is KUOW's Week in Review. We're going to spend the next hour learning from the week's top stories. Shell Oil's Arctic drilling rig entered Elliott Bay yesterday, despite dozens of kayak protesters. Alaskan officials have pointed out that these protesters and Seattle politicians are opposing Arctic drilling, even though we enjoy the benefits of cheap oil. Cheap oil fuels Boeing planes, global trade through Seattle, our employees travel to work on fossil fuel. Seattle Channel host Joni Balter, are Seattle's environmentalists and city leaders hypocrites?
Oh, you bet. You bet. About half the oil sloshing around here comes from the North Slope, and we live with it. We live with it. So you can't be, you can oppose this for a whole bunch of reasons, but you can't oppose it because you don't have anything to do with North Slope oil.
But is it important that we're hypocrites? Does it mean any difference as to whether you oppose drilling in the Chukchi Sea, that you know that we run on cheap oil?
You can know that and be trying to improve on that. You can go out and get an electric car if that's something that you want to do, in other words, and you can start riding your bike. You can do things to combat it, but you better be mindful of the fact that it is double talk.
So, yeah, that's what I'm trying to get at. What does it mean to be mindful of that? Because, for example, Alaskan officials have been saying, if you want to help the climate, shut down Boeing. These are our jobs. You have your jobs. You want to shut down our jobs. Associate editor of The Stranger, Eli Sanders.
I agree that we're all hypocrites to some degree, but I think action is more important than focusing on hypocrisy. If you just focus on the hypocrisy and make it paralyzing, then how do you create change? The people who are protesting in Elliott Bay are trying to get the attention of political leaders to move us off of a carbon economy, which, yes, we are all hypocritical participants in, although I will say I biked here this morning. Hmm. But a lot of those people probably drove their kayaks down to the water in cars burning Alaskan oil.
Very tough to fit on a bicycle. Very tough.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Well, let's talk to someone on the Alaskan side of this equation, the executive director of the North Slope Port Authority, Paul Foos. Paul, welcome to KUOW.
Good morning.
As I said, Alaska officials have been accusing Seattle of hypocrisy here. And as Eli put it, you can acknowledge the fact that you're using fossil fuel and still try to make change. What does it matter whether we're hypocritical on this issue?
Well, the main point I would make here is people are speaking against Arctic oil, but what is your alternative? And I'll tell you what it is right now. For the other 50% of the fuel that you burn down there, it's coming from the Canadian tar sands, it's coming from Angola, and it's coming from Russia. So that's your alternative. So we feel like Alaska, we have a much higher standard. It's really important to our economy. About a third of our economy is oil, and that's more than fishing, timber, mining, and tourism combined. So we take this as an overall attack on our economy by a state that we used to look at as a very good partner.
Eli, what about that point? Would you rather get your energy from Canadian sands, from the Bakken oil fields, from Saudi Arabia, from Russia?
I'd rather our political leaders in Washington State pay attention and move us away from dependence on oil. I'd rather drive an electric car, as Joni points out, although I can't afford one right now. I'd rather the government subsidize them incredibly so that they could become more affordable for people. I'd rather our state government invest more in mass transit so that people could get out of their cars rather than over-investing in highways. That's what I'd rather see.
Paul Foos, you're with the North Slope Port Authority. I mean, what Eli and a lot of people are directly saying is we want your industry to be the past. It's not the future for this planet.
Well, we don't understand why we're singling out Alaska when oil is the world's awash in oil. It's everywhere. The United States with shale oil alone has 100 years supply. So this is really a meaningless argument. And, you know, we just happened to be kind of a drive-by shooting. I was really struck by the people who testified. You know, we had a lot of our native people that live on the North Slope there speaking for their interests. They were just completely disregarded. It was just like we didn't exist. So I guess it's easier to go against somebody that you don't feel that you know. That's part of the reason we all flew down there to say, hey, we're people, too. We're up here. We're your partners. We worked with you for a long time. Why are you throwing us away?
You might have flown down here in Boeing jets, by the way. But we're not singling Alaska out. We're singling out oil, the people who are protesting this drilling ship. And you ask why, as if there's no fathomable explanation. The reason why is because burning oil contributes to climate change. I think you would agree with that, or I'd be curious as to whether you do agree. And
I do agree with it, but it's really a consumption issue, not a production issue. So if you want to change that, you know, like you say, go to electric cars or don't fly in an airplane anymore. You know, we brought the analogy of the Boeing plant. Well, if you really want to do something, you guys would be advocating for shutting down Boeing's plant. You know, each one of those planes made there, it will emit about 500,000 tons of CO2, and they're making 700 of them a year. So I guess it's a lot easier to attack us and to say, oh, look, here's the source of carbon production down here. Now, we don't want to shut down the Boeing plant, but we're using that as an analogy. That's the biggest producer, and Washington produces twice as much CO2 as Alaska does.
You might come around on this point and link arms with our socialist city council member who wanted to nationalize Boeing. You guys could get together and figure out what to do with the planes.
I want to bring in Chris Vance, public policy consultant, former chair of the Washington Republican Party. Chris, what do you have to say?
Well, the problem with the argument of let's move away from oil is if you look at this realistically, we'd all love to move away from oil. Climate change is real. Ocean acidification is real. But the problem is we are so dependent upon petroleum, it will take decades, if not centuries, to, quote, move away from oil. None of the alternatives actually work in today's economy. We're going to, whether anyone likes it or not, the fact is we're going to be burning coal, natural gas, and oil for a very long time. The solution is to find ways to burn it more cleanly through carbon capture, through cleaner burning cars, through electric cars. Yes, through more mass transit. But to just say we're immediately or even in the anytime near-term future going to move away from oil is not grown-up thinking. The real danger here is that the elected officials in Seattle and the port are going to make decisions that are going to make it difficult for the port to compete for business. Because the reality is there's going to be drilling in the Arctic, like it or not. Shell's not going away. The only question is, are they going to bring their business to Seattle or the Canadian ports or the other West Coast ports? And if we put up the only effect these protesters are having is to further lessen the competitive stance of the Port of Seattle.
It doesn't make sense to say don't drill or don't do anything unless you have a sense of what the cost of that is. Does anybody here have a sense of what would we sacrifice if magically Shell dropped its effort or President Obama changed his mind and we didn't drill on the Chukchi Sea?
Nothing. Because as Chris points out, a lot of these solutions to the problem are decades out, but also developing the Arctic oil resources are decades out by Shell's own admission. And so it's not like they are going up there this summer to pump a bunch of oil that we need to use next fall or whatever. They're going up there to look and see if something might work. And this idea of inevitability, it's not inevitable. Shell is the only oil company that is gambling on exploiting oil in the Arctic Sea. Other oil companies have looked at this and said, we don't want to take the risk. So one, political leaders didn't have to allow it. Two, Shell doesn't have to do it. And three, we don't need it. We'll get by without it because it's not coming anyway for a while.
Okay, let's give a last word or another chance to Paul Foos, former mayor of Dutch Harbor, Alaska, by the way, now heading up the North Slope Port Authority. What's your final argument here, Paul?
Well, I just have to really disagree with the last thing that the last speaker said. There are other companies that are interested. They're just waiting to see how Shell gets treated and about they're able to get their permits and operate. But it's not going to stop Arctic oil. Russia's full steam ahead. Canada's full steam ahead. Greenland, Norway, you know, and ironically for us, if all that other goes ahead and we get blocked, we're going to get all the risk of that oil being shipped through our waters, but we'll get zero of the benefit. That doesn't seem like a good deal for us.
Paul Foos from the North Slope Port Authority. Paul, thanks for joining us on KUOW.
Thank you.
Reaction? He's saying someone's going to get this oil, and we would be better at safety regulations and better for it to be American oil.
And that's exactly right. There's literally billions of gallons of oil in the Arctic yet to be discovered and drilled for. Someone is going to do that. It's going to happen. Again, the answer here is to promote policies to burn this stuff more cleanly until Nirvana arrives sometime in the future and we can live in a
Nirvana's
world
with, coming?
Without
awesome.
Without petroleum products. You know, I mean, it's not just biking down to drop the kayak in the water. The kayak's made of plastic, which comes from oil. The petroleum industry is centrally ingrained to our economy. It's not like divesting from tobacco companies. We can't do without the petroleum industry right now. And again, the only effect of this is they're going to drill in the Arctic. It's do we want the Seattle waterfront to be nothing but fish and chips and Ferris wheels and cruise ships or a working port?
So I'm thinking about this perhaps more locally. And I'm thinking, A, what came into Puget Sound yesterday was the ugliest thing I've ever seen come into these waters. But B, you can't unsell that house. In other words, just because you think that the people you sold to after the fact have Dobermans or painted the house purple or something like that. You know, one of the reasons people don't like to do business with government is they are subject to these political winds. And here you have a situation where the port had the authority, apparently, to cut this deal. It cut the deal. People don't like it. And if you don't like it, you can vote every single port commissioner out, possibly with the exception of Tom Albro, who did try to pull back the authority without a second vote on that.
Okay, last word, Eli.
I want to reframe the question slightly. Saying some other country is going to do it or someone else is going to do it, that is essentially a recipe for a race to the bottom. And what about leading by example? That is what the people who are out in Puget Sound are saying. We should set an example of moving rapidly away from an oil-dependent economy, and our country should not be drilling in the Arctic because we don't need to, because it's too dangerous, because we can devote our energy to better things.
Race to the bottom versus set an example. We will be talking about this again because this is not the only top story of the week that involves that question. So again, Shell's drilling rig moved into Elliott Bay yesterday. A couple of dozen kayaks greeted it peacefully. Protesters say they will return in larger force tomorrow. KUOW reporter John Ryan will be there. You'll find all of our coverage of these issues at KUOW.org. And then the really big news, looking ahead this morning, the really big news on oil drilling happened this week in Washington, D.C. What was President Obama thinking? We're going to have that discussion in 20 minutes. Stay tuned. You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review, when we discuss, debate, learn from the week's top stories. I'm Bill Radke. Washington state legislators are getting a healthy pay raise, 11% over 2 years. A state commission approved it this week. Do they deserve it? Well, they did make some laws this year, but they didn't pass a budget, which is why they're getting paid right now to be in a special session. And the budget they do pass will certainly not give state workers anything near an 11% raise. Republican Chris Vance, you are a former state legislator. Do they deserve this raise?
Well, let's first talk about how the process works. In this state, legislators don't enact their own pay raises. They establish a commission to analyze what other like positions are paid across the country and make a decision based upon the data. So given that, yes, they deserve a pay raise. But they've certainly not covered themselves in glory this session, and the timing on this is horrible. They are more gridlocked down there right now than I think I've ever seen them. It's not just the normal will we or will we not raise taxes battle over the budget. It's the McCleary decision has introduced an entire new element of complexity to this. And Ross Hunter pointed out a few weeks ago, the problem is that they have not been holding enough hearings and digging deeply enough into this issue. So the solutions that are being proposed, such as the levy swap, are coming so late in the session, they're just not ready to deal with it. Why weren't they, you know, more serious about this back in January? So I think there's been a real lack of performance this year. But looking at the long term, if you don't pay lawmakers a competitive salary, you don't get very good people to run for office.
Okay, so in the end, I know what the state commission said, but you, Chris Vance, think they deserve this raise or don't?
Well, based upon their current performance, no. Based upon the data of how other lawmakers are paid around the country, yes.
Joni?
I'm up for the raise. I think that, you know, there's never a good time to give public officials a raise. I'm up for it, but I would like to create a chart sometime here where you take all the lawmakers who didn't turn down the raise and run it against how they vote on sort of raises for teachers or a $12 statewide minimum wage. I'd like to know sort of how they perform thereafter. The raise goes into effect in September. It is the result of a commission that was created by the legislature, and the voters ratified that in 1987. So this is the system the voters wanted. The 11.5, you know,
well, we know
I can't speak to that specific number, but that is what they came up for.
Yes.
You don't want just wealthy lawmakers. I don't.
This legislature is not going to give state workers an 11% pay raise, I can guarantee you. So are you saying, no, then they don't deserve it?
No. It doesn't have to be. No, okay. It doesn't have to be the exact same number.
Okay.
The commission is out there doing what it does, and it came up with this number. But I would like to know if these lawmakers, how they respond to other questions about wages. The statewide minimum and teachers, for example.
I agree with Joni, and I get the emotional reaction to this. They're not doing anything. They're saying no to raising the minimum wage. They're saying no to raising teachers' wages. Your gut says it's disgusting for them to give themselves a raise. But look at what they're raising themselves to. It's from $42,000 a year to something like $47,000 a year.
Well, they don't work all year long.
Well, they actually, a lot of them do. That's one of the fallacies of talking about the legislature. Very often people say, oh, it's a part-time legislature, but you to stay in it and to stay engaged, it really is a full-time job. And I think we actually would want our legislators to be able to have it as a full-time job. And so on that sense, I agree with Chris and Joni. I would like to see legislators' salaries go up even further. And I would like to see people who can really commit to thinking seriously about lawmaking all year round and who are high caliber thinkers drawn into that work. At the same time, I would like to see us decrease the allowable contributions to lawmakers.
And that's a
raise
really,
their
that's
salary,
a really
tighten up public or campaign finance reform, and you'd get a really improved outcome.
Well, the current maximum that you can contribute to somebody running for the legislature is only $1,900. So that limit's already very low. But that's a very good point that we as a state need to decide, do we want a full-time legislature or a part-time legislature? Because right now we're sort of in the gray area in between. The real issue, though, here is what the commission looked at is what the salaries are for the other statewide elected officials, because they are honestly grossly underpaid.
Before we get there, can I bounce something that Eli just said off of you, because you are, again, a former state legislator.
Yes.
Is it true that more money makes for a better legislator?
Yes, I think so.
How does that – give me a specific example of how that works, because you know stuff we don't.
Because everybody – serving in the legislature takes about half of your time year-round. While you're in Olympia, it takes 120% of your time. So anybody out there in the middle of their career, it's very hard for them to go run for the legislature. It's hard to go in and say, hey, boss, I'm going to be gone for 6 months. If it actually paid a living wage – you'd get people who were not just independently wealthy or retired or that sort of thing. You'd get a different type of people who in the middle of their working careers could go become a lawmaker. You'd get a different type of lawmaker.
Okay. So is it not possible to say, yes, they deserve a raise and we'll give them a raise in a time when we have extra money in the state budget for raises, and we're not underfunding education and all the other litany of things that we've said. We're out of money, say the lawmakers themselves.
Well, you have to realize that every year there would be a reason not to give them a raise. You
okay.
would say we're deep in the recession. We're in the fifth year of cutting budgets. We don't have enough money for education. We would have a reason constantly. This is after, as I understand it, after about 7 years of no raises, the governor is not going to take his raise. You cannot take it. You can't vote on this, but you cannot take it or give it back to charity or give it to the general fund. And that's what I'm interested to see, which lawmakers do that because they don't think anybody else should get a raise.
But there is always this talk in the legislature about pay for performance and rewarding, you know, good outcomes from workers rather than just giving you raises for no reason. And so I really do get that impulse to say, we'll pay you when you actually perform. But when you reflect on it, Joni's right and Chris is right as well. It's better that this be done by an outside commission. You would every single year have a reason to say you haven't performed well enough.
Okay, our panel is unanimous. Listeners, you have a say too. Lawmaker salaries will rise in September unless there's a citizens' referendum to challenge it. It's 11% over 2 years for lawmakers, 4% for your governor. And Joni says your governor will take zero of that, right? Coming up on The Week in Review, is Seattle losing its authentic, artistic, bohemian culture? And is it fair to blame the tech bros? We'll talk about that in 25 minutes. KUOW's Week in Review, we're discussing the top stories of the week and figuring out what they all mean. Seattle is considering a ban on smoking in all of its parks. The ban is opposed by the American Civil Liberties Union. The ACLU says banning smoking in parks would be unfair to homeless people. Eli Sanders, your newspaper, The Stranger's, written about this. Would a smoking ban fall unfairly on homeless people?
I've been thinking about this quite a bit, and I haven't quite sorted it out for myself, and I don't know that we have as a paper, although we've reported on this quite a bit. And one thing we did in our reporting was look into how often, under the current law, tickets are even written for smoking in parks. It hardly ever happens. I think it happened once or twice last year. So I'm not sure how often this would be enforced, but I get the concern that if you tighten up the law, you squeeze out one final area for homeless people to smoke. And, you know, the mayor has said, well, this is a public health intervention. Public health is better served by chasing people out of any area where they can smoke and making it harder to smoke, period, in the hopes of people not smoking. I think for homeless people, maybe our first intervention should be, you know, somewhere upstream of their smoking habit. And here's a proposal that I thought of just as we were pondering this over the week, knowing we were going to talk about this. If Seattle went ahead and gave free housing to homeless people, like, by the way, Utah does, Salt Lake City, not a place that we think of as more liberal than us, but if we gave free housing to every homeless person, they would have a place to smoke. They can smoke in their own homes, and we would never have to worry about it being in our parks.
We could talk about that as part of the solution to the problem of lots of things falling unfairly on people without a place to live. I want to get at the ACLU's objection, sort of an accusation, if you ask me, is that Seattle police would not just that it would fall on homeless people because they're poor and have no place else to go, but that police would disproportionately enforce this on homeless people. In other words, move the people who they don't like along. Is that fair, Joni?
Well, I think this is one of the weakest arguments I've ever seen from the ACLU, sort of misinterpreting the mission of Seattle Parks. What is the mission? I looked it up. To provide welcoming and safe opportunities to play, learn, contemplate, and build community. I mean, nowhere in the mission does it say that Seattle Parks are, shall we say, affordable housing. And to make the mission of the parks in this regard about the homeless, isn't it supposed to be about the greater good? And, you know, many, many cities have banned smoking in the parks. And every year we're going to be asked to pay quite a lot for parks. But this isn't a question about housing for some folks. So I think this is sort of a distortion of what the parks actually do.
But actually, right now, smoking is your right in the park, right? I mean, it is taking away
25 feet of another person. You can't. This is never enforced, just like the indoor smoking rule that says you have to be 25 feet from a building. They never enforce that either.
And we have that law. You can't smoke 25 feet from someone in a park.
Go look at a building and you'll see the folks next door to it puffing away.
I have a concern about the logic, though, that you're putting forward, that parks are not for homeless people. If you take that to its conclusion, then you might as well ban homeless people from parks, which I don't think any of us would want to do.
I don't think I said that. I think I said that you cannot make the rules for a small slice of the people who use the park. And that is what that does.
But the rule is for everybody. Everybody can smoke in a park right now without 25 feet away.
So I think because it's so impossible to enforce the 25-foot rule, and because if you believe in no smoking, and that includes pot, everybody, but if you believe in no smoking and a healthy place for children and families and all this, you have to end up, I do anyway, smoking in the parks.
That's what
no
you mean by going along with the welcoming, parks must be a welcoming environment, not that the
just read you the mission. They could change it, but they haven't.
On the ACLU's argument, I mean, if the Seattle police and the city of Seattle were determined to drive the homeless out of the parks, they'd have done it long ago. There's already laws against vagrancy and loitering and that sort of thing. I find it hard to believe in Seattle's culture that they're going to use the police to drive the homeless out of the parks. But I actually agree with Eli. During the winter months, my wife manages a homeless shelter for women. and I volunteer there a lot. And the idea that we should just surrender to the idea that the homeless are just have nothing better to do but hang out in the parks all day and not get services and counseling and job placement and the treatment they need and housing and free housing, I think that's surrendering. The idea that we just accept the fact that, we're going to have a parks full of homeless who are often mentally ill should cause us to reexamine our whole philosophy about this. We should not accept that somebody is going to be like permanently homeless and the only place they can smoke is in the parks. The homeless need to be getting treatment, services, and housing, not being allowed to just hang out in the parks. It's not good for them or society.
Well, let me be clear. So until all that happens, do you want to ban smoking in parks or not?
I hate cigarettes. My mom died of lung cancer, and I hate cigarettes, so I'd like to ban them pretty much everywhere. But the issue here is really the motivation of why they're proposing this ban. Mm-hmm. Some people are saying it's targeted at the homeless. I think it's targeted at cigarettes.
I agree with that. I think it's targeted at cigarettes, at all the cigarette butts that are left behind. And just the general use of the park is in the hand. The greater number of people who use the parks shouldn't, you know, it's not about the homeless. It's about the greater number of people using the parks. And they have a right to be in a smoke-free environment there.
I do get the concern that maybe animating the ACLU's complaint here that parks are becoming a playground just for the rich in this city, or that the city period is just becoming a playground for the rich, and that you want to preserve some areas that, you know, harken back. If Knut was here today, he would remind us about all the lawlessness and bad habits in Seattle of the past, right? That is our city. That's our heritage. So preserving some spots where you can do things that are maybe not good for yourself or even for the greater good.
Where are the cell phone videos of Seattle police allowing people with L.L. Bean fleece jackets that look well off to smoke while somebody else doesn't get to smoke? I mean, is that...
There aren't any of those. That's why.
There aren't. Joni's right. Because this law is never enforced right now. Yeah. I mean, it's a strange solution to a problem that is not really recorded very well in city records as a problem to begin with.
Well, but just because, you know, in the old days everybody smoked when they didn't have the benefit of all the science about how horrible smoking is for you, that doesn't – my nostalgia doesn't say, well, then let's do it that way.
I agree with that. I'm not saying that people should smoke. I don't smoke. I don't like sucking down someone else's secondhand smoke. I'd actually prefer that you stay, you know, way away from me in a park if you're smoking. I get that sentiment too. I just fall on the side of, well, if we are going to apply a law to the city – that has the effect of removing maybe one of the last places for homeless people to smoke, I would like to see us also commit ourselves to more services, as Chris is saying, and housing.
You act like we're the only city that's contemplating this. New York City, Portland, San Francisco, LA County.
Has already done it, I think, right?
They've already done it, and the world is still turning.
Although people complain that New York has increasingly become a playground for the rich.
I think that the theme of this show is liberal cognitive dissonance. Mm. You know, on one hand, we hate cigarettes. Oh, boy, it's politically incorrect to smoke. But on the other hand, we got to watch out for the homeless. And at the same time, we got to ban everything having to do with oil. It just incoherent public policy is the result.
Seattle may be as ambivalent as our panel is right now on this topic. The park commissioners keep putting off the discussion of a ban on smoking in parks. It's now set for Thursday, May 28th. So again, listeners, you still have a chance to make your voice heard about a total ban on smoking in Seattle parks. Coming up on The Week in Review, I quote Jeremy from our Facebook page, who writes, "The programmers and predatorial tech class needs to go. Seattle now feels like the suburbs." End quote. Is it fair, as some do, to blame the programmers, Amazon and other Seattle tech workers, for eroding Seattle's personality? That discussion is coming up in about 20 minutes on KUOW Seattle. The week happened, a lot of big news this week, and we're trying to figure out what it means on The Week in Review. This week, President Obama gave preliminary approval for Shell Oil to drill in the Arctic with a fleet moored in Puget Sound, and that oil rig has floated into Elliott Bay. Now, scientists say to slow climate change, we need to burn less fossil fuel, not more. So, is President Obama a climate change denier? Our next guest says he is. Bill McKibben founded the Global Climate Campaign, 350.org. Bill McKibben, welcome to KUOW.
Good to be with you.
How is President Obama a climate change denier?
Well, I mean, he's not the denier in the classic Republican stick your fingers in your ears and pretend physics isn't real sense. But the Arctic thing makes it clear how he and most other status quo politicians are engaging in something kind of similar. I mean, it's one thing to give long speeches about how immoral it would be to leave a ruined planet behind if you then don't go and sign off on something that scientists have told you will cause massive climate change. I mean, we had a paper in January from Nature. It said if we wanted to meet the 2-degree temperature target that all the limiting global temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius, something that all the countries of the world, including the U.S., have signed off on, if we wanted to do that, there is, quote, no scenario, unquote, in which you can take oil and gas out of the Arctic. There's just too much carbon up there. Think about what's going on right now. Shell and the other oil companies warned by scientists that if we continued down the fossil fuel path, we would melt the Arctic, kept right down that path, and what do you know, the Arctic began to melt. Did they look at that and say, maybe we should become energy companies and start investing in solar or wind? No, they doubled down and said, now that the Arctic is melted, we'd like a license to go drill there. It's like a tobacco company applying for a license to go put cigarette machines in cancer wards.
Asking how much we hold President Obama responsible with Bill McKibben, I'm going to let President Obama speak for himself, and then I'd like to hear what you think, Bill.
Keep in mind that my approach when it comes to fracking, drilling, U.S. energy production of oil or natural gas has remained consistent throughout. I believe that we are going to have to transition off of fossil fuels as a planet in order to prevent climate change. I am working internationally to reduce our carbon emissions and to replace over time fossil fuels with clean energies. Obviously, we started home with all the work that we've done to, for example, double the use of clean energy. But I think that it is important also to recognize that that is going to be a transition process. In the meantime, we are going to continue to be using fossil fuels, and when it can be done safely and appropriately, U.S. production of oil and natural gas is important. I would rather us, with all the safeguards and standards that we have, be producing our oil and gas rather than importing it, which is bad for our people, but is also potentially purchased from places that have much lower environmental standards than we do.
Environmental writer Bill McKibben, isn't the president buying time while we work on alternative energy until that gets cheap?
Look, the Arctic oil that Shell wants to drill, they've said it'll take 20 years before they can start to bring it online. If you think that in 20 years we're still going to be doing the same things we're doing now, then we might as well give up the conversation about global warming and, you know, go on to solving who's going to smoke in the park or whatever. because that's not what the science tells us.
What about the president's argument that nobody does safety regulations like the USA as opposed to these other countries?
There's no safe or unsafe way to burn oil when it comes to carbon emissions. You can burn it in an open oil drum, and you can burn it in the fanciest car in the world, and that gallon of gasoline produces the same amount of carbon. That's how carbon dioxide works, so the issue of safety regulations doesn't have anything to do with it. It's not that President Obama hasn't done nothing. I mean, he's done more than President Bush did about this, but, you know, I've drunk more beer than my 14-year-old niece, too. The question is not, you know, how low a bar can we meet? The question is, can we meet the bar that physics sets? And that's why it's so exciting that all around Seattle there are people rising up this weekend. I mean, Seattle's the real hub of the environmental universe this weekend. All eyes on Seattle, as lots and lots of people are going to be turning out in kayaks and canoes and along the shore to say we do not need that energy and we don't want Seattle implicated in one of the great environmental crimes of our time.
We're talking with environmentalist Bill McKibben. Republican Chris Vance, we're not just talking about Arctic oil. We're talking about a dismay focused this week from President Obama's supporters who feel let down by this president over and over. You have been a lawmaker. How big a political price would President Obama pay if he put his money where his mouth is and just banned all Arctic offshore oil drilling? He has the power to do that.
He would pay no political price because he's not running for reelection. He can do the right thing. And in this case, he's done the right thing. You know, the problem with the argument against oil was Bill just summed it up. Yeah, we will be burning oil and coal and natural gas 20 years from now, probably 40 years from now, 80 years from now, 100 years from now, because solar and wind, he said, just why can't Shell just become a solar and wind company? You know how much wind power it would take to replace petroleum in this country? It would take a wind farm the size of Texas through California combined. It's physically impossible. Solar and wind and all the alternatives together make up less than 10% of our energy, and that's not going to change for a very long time. So we will need Arctic oil in the long-term future. The solution is technology like carbon capture and other technologies to burn this stuff more cleanly. Not this kind of childish idea that we can tomorrow transition to an alternative that doesn't exist.
So, hi, Bill. This is Joni Balter. And I just wanted to say, you know, I know that environmentalists, you know, they go to an end of the spectrum and they feel disappointed in President Obama. But in fairness, he has done probably more for climate change than any other president that we've had. You know, the U.S.-China targets, those are very, very important if you think about this. So you're just really saying he hasn't done everything that environmentalists want. And sometimes that is something that's a little frustrating for folks, because if he doesn't do everything, then he didn't do, it sounds like, anything. And that's not fair either. And I have a degree in this stuff while we're at it.
The question is not whether or not the president has done more than other presidents have done. The question is... This is not, and yeah, of course, that's what I said. In this case, the fundamental dispute is not between Republicans and Democrats or environmentalists and industry. It's between human beings and physics. And if you don't do enough, I mean, you got to think what you guys are facing there in Washington. The snowpack is disappearing from the mountains. You had the biggest forest fire you ever had last year. Sea level rise, as we learned in a series of studies this week, is accelerating. Now, if, as your colleague there from the GOP said, there was nothing we could do about it, that would be, I guess, one thing. But there's plenty we can do about it. In the last 6 years, the price of solar panels has plunged 75%. Entrepreneurial innovation, which usually Republicans champion, is going full bore all over the world now. We are installing far more renewable energy than anything else. The use of coal in China has now apparently peaked. They've become the biggest installers of sun and wind. We know how much sun, wind, geothermal, hydro it would take to power the United States. A study from Stanford 2 years ago said it's entirely possible to do it, and by 2030, at costs comparable to what we'd pay for fossil energy. The reason we're not doing it is because there are vested interests in the fossil fuel industry who've been able to gum up the political system. They're even able, yes, to influence Democratic politicians and keep them from doing all that they need to do. So, you guys have partisan take on this. That's not where I'm coming from.
Chris, you'll get a chance to respond when we talk about what the University of Washington divested itself from this week. Bill McKibben, will you hang on the line with us and talk about that?
Happy to.
Okay, right back in a moment on KUOW's Week in Review. We're back at KUOW's Week in Review with Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Chris Vance, and on the line with us is Bill McKibben, who founded the Global Climate Campaign, 350.org. He wrote The End of Nature, has written widely about the climate. And this week, the University of Washington's Board of Regents voted to sell off its investments in thermal coal. That's the kind of coal used to generate power. Even the regents say this is a symbolic gesture, and it will cost the university money, $13 million, that could go to scholarships. Is this worth it? Bill McKibben, any reaction?
Well, in the first place, it shouldn't cost them any money, or at least it wouldn't have if they'd sold it 5 years ago when we started asking. The price of thermal coal stocks has fallen 87% in the last 5 years. It's been the single biggest drug on the entire market. In fact, portfolios without fossil fuel on them are now outperforming conventional or the broader stock market by about 1.2% a year, 120 basis points, which is an enormous amount. The reason for that is because the economics of energy are changing, and changing far more rapidly than most people know. And that's why it's not just the University of Washington that's divested from fossil fuel. It's, or in their case, begun to divest. It's Stanford. It's on and on down the list. Maybe the most important of those announcements came last September in New York, the day that 400,000 people marched through the streets in the largest demonstration about anything in this country in a number of years. That evening, the Rockefeller family announced that they were divesting their philanthropies from fossil fuel, both because they said it was immoral and imprudent financially to be there. I mean, this was the first family of fossil fuel, the original oil fortune. They said if John D. Rockefeller were alive today, he'd be looking to make his money in green energy. So I say, go Huskies. This was a smart business decision, but it was also a smart recognition that universities, which are about the future, can't be tying their finances or any of the other parts of their operation so deeply to the past.
Does anyone here fault the UW's Board of Regents on this?
No, they made a brilliant move. They divested themselves from a tiny, tiny portion of their portfolio, doing no real harm to the portfolio, but yet politically able to appease the left, while they chose purposely not to divest themselves from the oil stocks, which are much bigger. But look, in the broader sense here, grown-ups have to make real public policy using reality. And the reality is that for the long-term future, petroleum is going to continue to be the overwhelming provider of our energy. It's not because of politics. People who lose always blame the other guy's smart political tactics or campaign contributions. It's because oil and coal and natural gas is still the cheapest, most efficient way to provide the energy our economy needs. In the old days, that used to be wood and whale oil. Now, the world would be a wonderful place when we finally get to the point where we don't need oil and coal and natural gas. I think that'll be great. I look forward to it. But the market is going to decide that, not people in kayaks.
Before we leave divestment, I have never heard anyone argue that divestment from South Africa in the 80s by universities had no effect, but that it was galvanizing in that movement. Is this any different?
I was talking to former Mayor Mike McGinn yesterday, and he brought up the apartheid divestment movement as something that is very analogous to what's going on now, and that the shantytown effort where people, as I understand it, constructed shantytowns on university campuses to kind of prick people's moral conscience in America was very effective, and that is what is being attempted by the kayakers on Puget Sound. And I want to add in one more thing. The market is not going to solve this problem. We are seeing right now that the market has not and will not solve this problem. And when you factor in the costs of Arctic drilling, we have to add one more element to the discussion. Chris has talked a lot about grown-ups making policy and so on. I don't know if I count as a grown-up in his eye, but there are grown-ups in the federal government who have studied the percentage chance of an oil spill if we allow Arctic drilling. So set aside all the climate concerns, the federal government says there's a 75% chance of a major spill in the Arctic if we allow the type of drilling that Shell wants to do with this rig that's now parked on the Seattle waterfront.
Joni?
The UW is just a tad bit like President Obama in the earlier discussion here, if you think about it. Practical, nuanced, not 100%. And that is how sort of successful entities kind of work.
They didn't pull out of all fossil fuel business, just the what most people agree is the worst offender, which
right.
when it
and
comes
it does
to carbon,
send a message,
which is coal.
And it does make a difference, and it does join Stanford and the University of Maine state campuses. It matters.
Well, let's give a last word to Bill McKibben. Thank you for joining us, Bill. Final thoughts this week on the news of the week and the global environment.
You know what? The reason that markets can't solve this problem is because we've never asked fossil fuel to pay the price for what it's doing. There's no price on carbon, which is a shame because we're facing the greatest crisis that humans have ever faced. No one's argued with that. Everyone's just said, oh, we should do it slowly or something. Well, slowly doesn't work for the physics. If you want to keep the sea from rising past the point where you can deal with it, if you want to have some snowpack there, you guys better get a little less cynical and a little more willing to really go to work. That's why it's really good news that there are a lot of people out in the streets of Seattle this weekend.
Before Bill McKibben was a grown-up, he was hanging out in a Seattle Union Hall with his longshoreman uncle as a kid. Now he's the founder of the global climate campaign, 350.org. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. What a pleasure, guys.
KUOW's Week in Review on a Friday. Coming up on the program, we're going to talk about changing Seattle. Cities change. Do you embrace it, tolerate it, move out, or blame the tech bros? That's when we come back on KUOW's Week in Review. Chris Vance, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, I'll have to interrupt your argument for now.
Sorry.
And that's okay. And talk about changing Seattle. A video produced in Seattle has gone viral because it captures something. It captures a feeling. The feeling that Seattle is being changed, improved, ruined, you put your word on it, by new money and new tech workers. This video is a parody of a real-life Amazon recruitment video. The original showed young workers telling recruits what they love about Seattle. The parody rewrites the script.
I've been here now for 6 years, and I can't imagine what this place must have been like before all the new money, colorful condos, and Ferris wheels. It sounds horrific.
The people here are really interesting. You have quite a mix of people in Seattle, but we're hoping to price most of those people out in the next few months.
A newly gentrified neighborhood makes you feel special, less human, too.
And it goes on from there. Now, you do not have to have seen this video to know that there is a resentment over Seattle's changing character. Is that real? Is it fair to blame tech success and tech workers for eroding Seattle's bohemian nature? Do you live on Capitol Hill? Yes, Eli?
I do, for now.
Okay, let's start with you, the strangers, Eli Sanders. Is you getting priced out?
Well, my rent is going up. I mean, it's steadily gone up all the time that I've lived on Capitol Hill, and that's been about 10 years. So I understand the feeling of a lot of people who are feeling squeezed out of a neighborhood that they thought was theirs. And a lot of my friends have had to leave for, you know, Columbia City, Beacon Hill, places that are more affordable. And when you look around on Capitol Hill, you do see that the people who are moving in are often, very often, new Amazon workers or people who are brought here by tech jobs. Now, I'm not going to join the modern equivalent of the old Lesser Seattle movement and say, shut the doors, you know, keep everyone out. I don't think we can do that. And I think that the struggle right now in Seattle is how to merge new jobs, which are good for our economy, and more Amazon workers coming here, which is inevitable, with the need to keep the city livable and affordable for more people than just Amazon workers.
So the original video, if it had been done by the chamber, nobody would have said a word. It just looks like a video done by boosters, shall we say. But the fact that it comes from Amazon made it ripe, you'd say, for parody. Most cities in the country, as in a piece I just did for Channel 9, quoting the mayor, would do a jig on top of the Space Needle. That's his quote. If they had a business like this here, yet I will say it's the pace of the change. It's so much, so fast that is changing the city and making people uncomfortable. This is a boom and bust city by history. And booms are like that. Booms come super fast, and they annoy people. And this one is.
Yeah. I was born here, and I've lived in the Seattle area my whole life. I live in Auburn now. Both my kids live in Seattle. I'm old enough to remember old Seattle, when Ballard really was Scandinavian, and J.P. Patches and hydroplanes, and when there was no Ferris wheel on the waterfront, and you didn't go to the waterfront because it was kind of a dangerous, seedy place. The change around here has been massive. And I understand people's angst over this. But the alternative, of course, is if you go to other cities, as I have, along the classic Great Lakes cities or a place like Baltimore we talked about last time I was here, those are dying cities. Seattle is vibrant and growing and economically prosperous, and people live downtown and stay downtown all the time. I understand people's angst, but what do you want? I mean, the alternative is a whole lot worse.
Another aspect of this angst, as someone called it, this annoyance, is the culture clash. So Capitol Hill, how long you lived on Capitol Hill, Eli?
10 years.
10 years. So do you feel dismissive of, superior to, annoyed by people of a different culture from you? It's not, you know, you do not.
I mean,
am I
people of a different culture than me? I, you know,
that means they earn more money.
Is that all it is? Or are they somehow? Are they? Because I'm not making this floating around. Is a kind of bigotry, if you will, but also an accusation that these people there. I've heard homophobic. I heard that basically they don't get our culture on Capitol Hill. Is that fair?
I don't get who these people are, even when people I know use the phrase. I don't think we've really wrapped our minds around who, quote unquote, these people might exactly be. But you look at the facts on the ground and things are different. There's been a rise in hate crimes on Capitol Hill. The rent is rising. The type of people, the more bohemian culture, as you called it, that used to be commonplace on the Hill is being squeezed out. So you look at that and you say, okay, it's being replaced by something, and it's easy to just say it's being replaced by those people. Mm. I'm not someone who says, I hate those people, round them up and send them off, but I do want to understand a little more who they are and what they're doing and why.
Okay, we're running out of time. I'll give the last word to Matt on Facebook, who says, it's still moderately affordable in South Seattle, hashtag Rainier Beach. So it's not like you can't move like people have always moved in Seattle.
And are doing right now.
Eli Sanders with The Stranger, associate editor, Pulitzer Prize winner. Joni Balter, Seattle Channel, the host of Civic Cocktail. Chris Vance is a public policy consultant now, former chair of the state GOP. Thanks for understanding the week's news with us.
Thank you.
We're on Twitter at KUOW. We're on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. Our producer is Jason Pagano. Get the podcast. We're on iTunes and Stitcher. Go to KUOW.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bill Radke. Back next week.